hecho presente. Partir on page 6, clause 19. Number 1, on page 11, from line 1, to omit paragraph C and to substitute. C, if the minister dissolves the board, comma, or if the board resigns, comma, or if the board becomes inoperable, comma, the minister, 1, may appoint an administrator to take over the functions of the board and to do anything which the board might otherwise be empowered or required to do by or under this act, comma, subject to such conditions as the minister may determine, and 2, in Roman figure, must as soon as it is feasible, but not later than 6 months after the event contemplated in paragraph C has occurred, comma, appoint new members to the board, and for this purpose, section 7 applies with changes required by the context. Full stop.
There we go. Any taker, clause 19, agreed to? Honorable Siavi.
I think we said, otherwise it should be mutatis mutandis, because we said the reasonable time or reasonable opportunity must be defined in terms of 7 days plus 7 days.
Agreed. Honorable Sherry, you were reading...
I'm reading page 10 of the bill.
Okay. Which line?
Line 49.
Line 49.
Line 49. The minister may dissolve the board only after having given the board a reasonable opportunity to make representation and after having considered any representation received.
Okay.
We said we need to define that reasonable opportunity as 7 days, working days, and the minister to respond to the presentation again in 7 working days.
Okay. Agreed to. Can we agree to the proposed inputs? Agreed. Can we now move advocate, let's proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. Still on clause 19, page 6, number 2. On page 11, from line 8, to omit subsection 2 and to substitute 2A, the costs associated with the appointment and functioning of the administrator shall be for the account of the administrator.
Agreed. Agreed to. Honorable Humsinga.
In a general sense, I can recall, and I made a note here, that we do understand the conditions under which an administrator would be necessary, but then it can't be for an unlimited period. It can't be like a continuous arrangement. And we then requested consideration for determining a period related to the condition where a small letter administrator is appointed.
Advocate. Noted.
Noted, Chairperson.
Okay. Can we proceed? Yes. Honorable Mpanza.
But Chair, I'm not comfortable with just noting. In everything, we have been specific. If we say 7 days, 7 days. If it's 3 months, it's 3 months. So I think maybe let's look at a specific time frame and just leave, not leave it open-ended.
Honorable Ramatlakana.
No, Chair. My assumption was that because the interim board was 6 months, that if you come to an administrator, which is something that happened immediately, you can't go beyond the 6 months that is already being prescribed for an interim towards the full. So I think it's just some consistency to keep it at that for a period of, see, not more than 6 months.
Okay. Mr. Willemse.
Chair, I think the concern has been addressed in Roman 2 of paragraph C that's being inserted, in that the minister must, as soon as it is feasible, but not later than 6 months after the event contemplated in C, appoint a new board.
Agreed to. Thank you very much. Let's proceed.
B. The appointment of the administrator terminates at the first meeting of the new board. Full stop.
Agreed to? Agreed. Thank you very much. Let's proceed.
Page 7, clause 20, number 1. On page 11, from line 15, to omit subsection 1 and substitute 1. The board must, comma, with the concurrence of the minister, comma, appoint a suitable, qualified and experienced person as chief executive officer on such terms and conditions of employment as may be determined by the board. Full stop.
Agreed. Well read and well done. Can we proceed?
Still on page 7, clause 21, number 1. On page 11, from line 21, to omit subsection 1 and 2 and substitute. Number 1, if the chief executive officer is for any reason absent or unable to carry out his or her duties, comma, or if a vacancy in the office of the chief executive officer occurs, comma, the board may, comma, with the concurrence of the minister, comma, appoint a suitable qualified person to act as a chief executive officer until the chief executive officer is able to resume his or her duties or until the vacant position is filled. Full stop.
Agreed to? Agreed. Let's proceed to 2.
Number 2. An acting chief executive officer, A, may exercise all the powers and must carry out all the duties of the chief executive officer, and B, is appointed on terms and conditions, comma, including those relating to remuneration and allowances, comma, as the board may determine. Full stop.
Agreed to. Honorable Musinga.
Chair, on the appointment of the acting CEO, there was a remark which I've made a note of here for how long that period would be. I just missed that. In other words, the acting CEO, for how long that would be.
Honorable Ramatlakane.
Again, relying on my memory, of the discussion, we did say that any acting position is already determined in terms of the rules. Currently, in terms of the DEPSA, there's the required period that you cannot act beyond this period. That will be applicable here, unless we want to insert that amount, but the PMFA will.
Can we agree to that one?
Agreed. Let's proceed. Clause 24, number 1. On page 11, in line 43, to omit board, comma, in consultation with the chief executive officer, comma, open in quotes, and to substitute chief executive officer, comma, in consultation with the board.
Vice versa.
Yes, Chairperson.
Agreed to? Agreed.
Clause 25, number 1, on page 11, in line 47, to omit the minister may, for good reason, comma, on recommendation of the board, and to substitute the board may for good reason with the concurrence of the minister. Full stop.
Agreed. Proceed.
Chairperson, clause 26 was the clause that was rejected by the committee, and there was new clauses that were proposed and inserted in the bill, and those clauses were read by the department for several times in the committee. If, with your permission, Chairperson, if you allow me, maybe not to read them, or I can read them, but with your permission, Chairperson.
Read the clauses.
Okay, Chairperson, thank you. On page 8.
Clause.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. Clause on page 8, clause 26, clause rejected. New clauses. 1, that the following be new clauses. Benefit account. The 26.1, the administrator must open and maintain a benefit account. Full stop. 2, the benefit account shall consist of A, road accident benefit scheme levies imposed in terms of the Customs and Excises Act, comma, 1964, in brackets, Act number 91 of 1964, B, money appropriated by Parliament, C, money loaned to the administrator, D, interest earned on money in the account, and E, investment returns on invested money from the account. Full stop.
There we are, the new clause. Benefit account, Honorable De Freitas.
Thank you, Chair. the invested money, where is the clause that talks about invested money to be invested?
Can we look at the clause that is speaking to invested monies?
Under powers and functions in section 6, paragraph E, subject to national legislation, invest any money and realize, and so it goes on. And that then should be read with the Treasury regulations that requires an entity to have an investment policy, but that's dealt with in the PFMA.
Application of money in the benefit account, number 27. The money in the benefit account shall, comma, subject to the provisions of this act, comma, be under the control of the chief executive officer, comma, and shall be applied by the chief executive officer for A, the payment of benefits provided for in chapter 6, B, costs related to the appointment of, comma, and the fees of, coma curator is appointed to assist claimants and beneficiaries. C. Subject to approval by the Minister of Transport, coma, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, coma, transfers to the transition account referred to in Section 28, and D. The payment of expenses related to the maintenance of the benefit account, full stop.
I'm looking at the definition section, and I didn't see a definition for curators. Let me just look at that.
Can you assist?
It's not in certain
definition of the curator.
It's not provided for in the bill. We'll have to make provision for it, Chairperson.
Okay. Honorable Ramatlakana, Honorable De Freitas.
We're saying that we agree with what has just been read into the record.
Okay. Agreed to the curator definition will be inserted because the definition is not there. Honorable De Freitas, a follow-up?
Yes, Chair. I just want, if when the definition is being drawn up, because it says your curator is appointed to assist claimants and beneficiaries, so that can just be included in there, exactly what that means. Thank you.
Okay. Honorable Musinga, Honorable Mpanza.
Thank you, Chair. Two aspects, 26.1 and 27, read together. On the one side, you have the administrator that must open and maintain a benefit account. And on the other hand, in 27, we say that the money and the accounts will be under the control of the CEO. I'm just putting control next to maintain. And just ask for consideration around practical management and operational access. Who then has control and who has access? And that there should be a clear distinction in terms of roles and functions between what we describe here as what the administrator should be, should do, and the CEO should do. Secondly, Chair, in relation to the ABCD, I ask for consideration to add an E, since there is no responsibility.
Where,
27. 27E. There's no expression of what we asked for in terms of support, financial support and payment, in other words, benefits towards contributing for the injured in preparation of a claim. That's not included here.
Honorable Ramatak, Honorable Mpanza.
The mind was not to deal with this. I was just piggybacking on the definitions that were left. The appeals board, there's no definition. So if we can also get a definition of that one.
Okay. Responses?
Chairperson, responding to Honorable Humsinga, that's well spotted. It will be included under E.
Okay.
Thanks. And then with regard to the definition, we'll also define that, the appeals committee.
Okay. Can we proceed? Transition account?
Transition account? Page 9, 28.1. The administrator must open and maintain a transition account. Full stop. Two, the transition account shall consist of A, money that belonged to the Road Accident Fund prior to the coming into effect of this Act, B, money appropriated by Parliament, C, money transferred into the transition account, comma, subsequent to the approval contemplated in section 27C. D, money loaned to the administrator. E, interest earned on money in the transition account. And F, investment returns on invested money from the account, full stop.
Again, Chair, just in terms of functions and roles relating to the control and maintenance between the role of the administrator and CEO in relation to 28D, money loaned to the administrator. Is it indeed loaned to the administrator or is it the CEO in terms of who has control? And then I'm getting confused as to who carries the ultimate accountability responsibility. So I think we clearly need to consider a section as to the operational expenses account and the benefits account, and to differentiate between the two of those as to who would be the accountable person between the administrator and the CEO.
Taken. Mr. Willemser.
I just want to comment on this, but we can certainly look at adding some clause to maybe clarify it. So the opening and maintaining of the account would be a board function. So board would have to approve the banker and the account, and it would have to ensure that that account is open and transacted on. In terms of signatory powers, in terms of transacting from the account, that would be for the CEO, operational issues would resolve. So that's the differentiation between the roles and functions amongst the two. As regards to loans, loans are made to the legal entity, which is defined in this instance as the administrator. So it's not money to the board or to the CEO, it is loans to the juristic person.
Are you comfortable, Honorable? Can we proceed?
Clause 29, application of money in the transition account. 29, the money in the transition account shall, comma, subject to the provisions of this Act, comma, be under the control of the Chief Executive Officer, comma, and shall be applied by the Chief Executive Officer for A, the payment of third-party compensation, comma, expect reports and litigation expenses under the Road Accident Fund Act, comma, 1996, in brackets, Act number 56 of 1996, comma, in respect of claims that arose prior to the coming into effect of this Act, and B, the payment of expenses related to the maintenance of the transition account, full stop.
There we are. Clause 29. Any taker? Agreed to? Thank you very much. Let's proceed. Operations account.
Clause 30, operations account. 1. The administrator must open and maintain an operations account. Full stop. 2. The operations account shall consist of A. Money appropriated by Parliament. B. Money donated or bequeathed to the administrator. C. Money that may become due to the administrator in terms of any other legislation. D. Interest earned on money in the operations account. E. Investment returns on invested money from the account. And F. Money recovered in terms of any insurance or reinsurance scheme. Full stop.
30. Any taker of clause 30? Honorable Humsinga?
If we could just get a bit of a practical example around 30F. Would that be short-term insurance, or what type of insurance would that be?
Mr.
Thanks, Chair. So the administrator has to look after the assets of the entity. One of those risk controls would tend to be to insure assets against damage. So you may have claims, so that is what's contemplated. We could also potentially have reinsurance in terms of, for instance, the claims liability that we have under the Road Accident Fund currently, and claims against that insurance that would come in.
Honorable De Freitas, follow up. Okay, proceed, Honorable Humsinga. Honorable De Freitas, you'll follow.
Chair, the insurance and the liability that can be reinsured, I'm not so convinced that that should be to the benefit of the operational account. Because if we're talking about the reinsurance, is that the reinsurance of the risk, which we can reinsure with, say, Hannover Re or Swiss Re or one of these bigger, in one of the big five world insurers, certainly then that would have to be to the benefit of the benefit account, not the operational account. Just an opinion.
Chair, I'm going to ask our actuary, just because they manage this better than I do. We have a cell captive at the moment, and my understanding of it is that it covers both. So we insure assets and claims liability, but I'm going to ask that you just respond.
Mr. Actuary.
Thank you. Through you, Chair. Thank you. Through you, Chair. So I think it can actually be a consideration, because the claims, the money that is received as a result of reinsurance claims actually end up being used to pay for other claims. So that portion, especially with respect to reinsurance recoverables, can then be allocated to either the transition account if that claim arose from the RIF Act, or it can also be allocated to the benefits account if that reinsurance is with respect to a claim under the RABS scheme. So yes, it can be considered to move that line with respect to reinsurance to the benefit account or to the transition account. Thank you.
Honorable, are you comfortable?
I'm comfortable, Chair, especially where there is a reinsurance of benefits relating to injuries other than what we normally would refer to as short term, where it's assets and so on. Both can be reinsured, understandably, but obviously where there's a income generated from reinsurance, that should go to the benefit account, not to the operations account. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Honorable De Freitas.
Can someone just explain B, money donated or bequeathed to the administrator? What money or bequeaths are we talking about?
Who's the paper?
There's a corollary to this provision in SASSA. So you may have someone that is so impressed with the new administrator that in the event that they die, they bequeath the sum to the legal entity. So there's provision made in the financing then of this scheme for such money to flow into the operations account.
Chair, where is that here? That explanation? Because it just mentions money donated to bequeathed. Is that details mentioned somewhere else? And if not, can we have it put it somewhere? Because it's very open and implies that people could bequeath stuff. And if that's the case, then surely there should be carefully monitored and controlled.
There's a principle of testatory, I'm sorry, my pronunciation may not be. Someone who bequeaths something is free to do it. So what is contemplated here is that someone bequeaths something to the legal entity. Other than saying that such money can flow into the account, I just want clarity on how else we would provide for that in the bill, other than what's stated here.
Honorable
Chair, in reality, I just don't see anybody bequeathing anything to the RA, to RABS or RAF. I just don't see it. You know, this isn't a charity or whatever. You know, I just so. But if in the off chance that it does happen, it's kind of just mentioned here in passing almost, and then kind of just left up in the air. Now, if it happens, how is this? It just, you know, I just see the lack of accountability here. That's my only concern. So I'm just saying, this should be noted somewhere. The explanation that's been given should be put somewhere, either in the definitions or something. It kind of just mentions here, so you know, it leaves the door open possibly to some funny business if using this particular clause.
Chair, I thought that the last time the engagement that we had, including the engagement with the Treasury, satisfied mostly the us that were worried about this, and that we should ride it. And I think Honourable De Freitas says doesn't see how this anybody will bequeath the money. I think he is correct. So I don't think necessarily we should stuck on that issue, because otherwise we now have to find a formulation on the hypothetical issues that may or may not arise. I would think that we should proceed on this, what has been a now almost like trio agreement on the suggested paragraphs here or clauses.
Honorable Mpanza.
Chair, I think I also took it that it's put here as a risk management a clause, because it's better that you have it and not to have it, because you are looking at the eventuality of that. Does when it happens, then at least there is something in the bill that actually talks about it. So for me, it's a risk management exercise, and I think it's good that we have it in that manner.
Honorable Humsinga.
Thank you, Chair. I'm looking in particular to Section 30D for Delta, where it suggests that interest earned on money in the operations account, which in principle, I'm asking the question whether at any stage one would consider extracting capital from an operations account to invest in order to earn interest for operational expenses, which is bad business. Is this what is envisaged here? Or should we think a bit further and also consider a description of the relationship between the two accounts and what would be allowed and what wouldn't be allowed in terms of money flowing from the benefit account and the operations account and vice versa? I would imagine that those two should be treated as silos, so that in particular there is no flow of any funds from the benefit account to the operations account. But I've just paged over unfairly, because we're not there yet, Chair, but so I didn't notice any attempt to just manage or describe the relationship between those two accounts. And in the absence of that, I'm arguing that under D, a possibility might arise where there's an investment of capital from the operations account, which would then open up you know, the benefits of receiving interest from that, which just should never happen. So in light of that, what is the relevance in having D, other than that this would originate from a separate investment? In other words, not, as I described, an extraction of capital from the operations account, but from somewhere else. And then I'm asking, what would that somewhere else be?
Honorable Ramatlakana, in the absence of the presence, if you can proceed. There's still conference, if you can proceed.
Well, when we're talking D and E, maybe we should get an answer first before we deal with it, because I think the Honorable Msinga raises a question of I don't see how this argument would creep into the bill, into this account. I don't see, because the investment is somewhere, is another sentence. So I don't see how that will creep in there. I thought it's the investment and what you do with the investment, the money earned on the investment. But certainly you can't take capital and to do in operations. So you can't do that in accounting. But let's hear what the response is. I thought that it was fine the way it's written unless there is a specific provision that we need to consider. Maybe let's do that. But the looking at the future, I don't know whether that this concern will actually happen, given the function that the RAPS was going to perform going forward. So I don't see, but they can answer to that question.
Advocate in the chief.
So, Chair, the accounts do operate in silos. There's no money flowing from the benefits account to the operations account or from the transition account to the operations account. The interest in D refers to day-to-day interest earned on that money in the account. Then there's also the under E, investment returns on invested money. Those are call accounts where the interest is higher in terms of money, not immediately. So between D and E, that just deals with the fact that there's some sum of money flowing into the account. In terms of money utilized, it's dealt with in 31. So that restricts the use of money in that account to what's provided for in Section 31.
Advocate.
Gilagalew, because I was going to refer to Clause 31 in terms of usage of the operations account.
Okay. Honorable Musinga, agreed to? Can we proceed?
Chairperson, page 10, clause 31, application of money in the operations account. The money in the operations account shall, subject to the provisions of this Act, be under the control of the Chief Executive Officer, and shall be applied by the Chief Executive Officer for A, the payment of administrative expenditure arising from the duties of the administrator set out in Section 5. B, the payment of administrative expenditure arising from the powers of the administrator set out in Section 6. C, the payment of remuneration and allowances of the board as provided for in Section 14. D, the payment of all non-claim liabilities of the former road accident fund as provided for in Section 63. And E, the cost of the actual valuations contemplated in Section 32. Full stop.
There we go. Clause 31. Agreed to? Okay.
Sorry, Chair. There was a previous amendment agreed in the benefits account to provide for financial assistance rendered to claimants and beneficiaries. So there will be a consequential amendment in this Section 31 because we've provided for that in Section 5. Mm-hmm. So 31A here would have to be qualified in that those costs would not be paid from this account but then from the benefits account earlier.
Agreed to? Can we go to clause 32?
Still on page 10, clause 32, actuarial valuations, the assets and the liabilities to be funded, respectively, from the benefit account and the transition account, shall be valued annually by an actuary appointed by the administrator, to determine the sufficiency of the money in the respective accounts. Full stop. 2. The result of the valuations referred to in subsection 1 shall be included in the administrator's annual report. Full stop. Number 3. Subject to subsection 4, the liabilities to be paid from the benefit account must, in the long term, be financed on a fully funded basis, 4. In the event that the ratio of actuarial value of assets to liabilities of the benefit account, expressed as a percentage, falls below 90%, the minister must take all reasonable steps provided for in this act to restore the ratio to 90% or above, and may, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, undertake a review of the benefits or an adjustment of revenue sources or both, taking into account the requirements of the Constitution, the impact of the public and the fiscal position of government. Full stop.
There we are, honorable members, honorable Humsinga, going, gone. Honorable Humsinga.
Thank you, Shay. Maintaining of the balance in terms of ratio, as described, in the benefit account, is it envisaged that the assets would only be of a monetary type? If so, where would the other assets they invest in terms of determining the balance between assets and liability?
Kim?
My understanding of this is that it's the money in the account. So a benefit must be backed up by a provision in the account, in terms of the benefits account. So if that ratio falls below the 90%, it then triggers this provision. So there are no assets in either the other than money in the transitional account or the benefits account.
Honorable Humsinga.
Chair, then I would recommend just a reconsideration of 32 sub 4, where the word assets indeed is used in relation to ascertaining that very fine ratio, or just include under assets that it's monetary assets, financial, that it's money in the or the fund itself, and not assets, because assets is interpreted in the wider term.
Is it clear? Okay, it will be considered. So considered, can we proceed to 33?
Clause 33, still on page 10. Consideration of actuarial valuations. 33.1. The administrator, the minister, the minister of finance, the minister of health, and the Minister of Social Development, or their delegates, page 11, provided that such delegation are not those contemplated in section 7C to F, shall meet within 30 days of receipt by the administrator of the actuarial valuations contemplated in section 32, to consider the financial position of the administrator and any remedial action that may be necessary. Full stop. 2. In addition to the matter contemplated in subsection 1, at the meeting, the respective ministers specified in Section 60 shall consider the adjustment of the tariff and treatment protocols, comma, annual average national income, comma, pre-accident annual income cap, comma, lump sum funeral benefit, comma, and the limit on the provision of vocational training. Full stop.
There we are, clause 31. Honorable Humsinga.
Just a question, Chair, in terms of that 33.1, particularly sections 7C and 2F, why are you excluding the DGs? Because you're saying the minister or its delegates accept the DGs. Why are you excluding the DGs of those departments?
Response.
The manner in which the board is constituted is the DGs or their delegates. In terms of the consultation, you cannot have those members participate in this discussion. It's required that there be an independent person, other than those that may have been delegated to form ex officio members of the board.
So how would it change it if it's the deputy DG?
He wouldn't be acting contrary to Section 50 of the PFMA, because he'll be acting in an independent capacity.
It's a pure compliance mandate.
Agreed. Thank you very much. Let's proceed.
Page 11, clause 27, number 1. On page 12, from line 14, to omit subsection 1 and to substitute 1, the administrator shall not be liable to provide a benefit, comma, nor is the liability of any person excluded, comma, in respect of bodily injury or death caused by or arising from the use of a vehicle, A, to perpetrate any terrorist activity, comma, as defined in the Protection of Constitutional Democracy Against Terrorist and Related Activities Act, comma, 2004, in brackets, Act Number 33 of 2004, or B, in circumstances where the producer, comma, importer, comma, distributor, comma, or retailer is liable for the harm in terms of Section 61 of the Consumer Protection Act, comma, 2008, in brackets, Act Number 68 of 2008. Close bracket. Full stop.
There we are. Clause 27. Agreed to. Let's go to chapter 6.
Chapter 6, number 1. On page 13, in line 2, after benefits, to insert and benefit review.
Agreed. Let's proceed.
Clause 29, number 1. On page 13, in line 4, after 29, to insert 1.
Agreed.
Number 2. On page 13, after line 13, to insert 2, the administrator may terminate, comma, suspend or review a benefit contemplated in subsection 1A to C for the reasons and in the manner provided for in Part E of this chapter. Full stop.
Any taker? Agreed to? Agreed. Thank you very much.
Page 12. Clause 31, number 1. On page 13, from line 43, to omit subsection 1 and to substitute 1, subject to the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act, comma, 2000, in brackets, Act Number 5 of 2000, comma, the administrator may enter into agreements with public and private sector healthcare service providers to provide for the delivery of health care services to injured persons. persons, full stop.
Agreed to. Thank you very much. Let's proceed.
Clause 32, number 1. On page 14, after line 24, to insert 2. A non-contracted health care service provider must obtain written approval from the injured person, comma, his guardian, comma, or curator, comma, prior to providing any health care service to the injured person that may result in a co-payment, comma, failing which the injured person and guardian shall incur no liability for the co-payment. Full stop. 3. In the event that the injured person requires an emergency health care service, comma, and the injured person, comma, his guardian, comma, or curator, comma, is unable to provide the consent contemplated in subsection 2, comma, the administrator will be liable for the reasonable co-payment. Full stop.
Clause 1 is section 1 of clause 32. Agreed to, Honorable Humsinga.
Chair, my apologies. I'm just curious as to section 31. Yesterday we still had the reference 31.1 reference to the Constitution in terms of section 217. Now that seems to be replaced with the Preferential Procurement Policy Act. Why was that done? What's the justification behind that?
Thanks, Chairperson. Section 217 requires of the state to come up with a an act, and that act is the PPPF. So we've done that, hence we are using the PPPF instead of section 217.
Did you get it, Honorable?
I heard it.
You heard it. But you're still trying to digest it in your... Okay, can we proceed? You'll come back. Okay, fine. Honorable Ramatlakana?
Oh. No, Chair, we're not coming back to,
okay,
to 31.
Agreed to.
So I don't think we should create a backlog like that. Now, Chair, maybe my comment on that is Section 217 just really prescribes that in a tender and participation by various bodies, allowance should be open. It should not be just for people that you're the booty and so on. So I think that's constitutional provision that everybody must participate. Then the act is specified in terms of that participation. So there is no contradiction, because this part comes from that constitutional provision, my understanding.
Okay.
Yeah, it's narrower. You can say so.
Agreed to. Let's proceed.
Still on page 12, clause 32, number 1. On page 14, after line 24, to insert... Sorry, Chairperson, I'm on number 2.
Okay.
Clause 32, number 2. On page 14, in line 25, to omit subsection 2 and to substitute 4.
Agreed.
What clause are we talking about?
Clause 32.
Eh?
Clause 32.
Mm-hmm. Okay. At line 14 is the one that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, it's fine. I agree.
Okay. Agreed to, Honorable De Freitas.
Sorry, I'm not. Just explain it.
So it's line 25 to omit 2 and substitute 4. Well, what is 4? I'm completely lost.
Can you assist the members with respect to what is being discussion here?
Chair, a new subsection 2 and 3 have been inserted above the old subsection 2. That old subsection 2 becomes subsection 4.
Okay. Understood. Thank you very much. Let's proceed.
Still on page 12, clause 35, number 1. On page 15, in line 51, to omit failed and to substitute was unable. Full stop.
Agreed to. Proceed.
Number 2. On page 16, in line 52, after benefit, to insert upwards. Full stop.
Agreed to. Let's proceed. Clause 39.
Clause 39. Clause rejected. Page 13. New clause. Number 1. That the following be a new clause. Liability of administrator in respect of funeral benefit. 46(1). Subject to this act, comma, the administrator shall be liable, comma, in respect of the funeral of a person whose death was caused by or arose from a road accident, to pay an immediate family member of the deceased, comma, a lump sum of 20,000 in the manner set out in the rules, comma, upon submission of a copy of the death certificate issued in terms of the Births and Deaths Registration Act, comma, 1992, in brackets, Act Number 51 of 1992, and B, proof that the death was caused by or arose from a road accident. Full stop. Number 2, the minister may, comma, with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance, comma, subject to affordability, comma, from time to time, comma, adjust the amount contemplated in subsection 1 upwards by notice in the Gazette to take into account the effects of inflation. Full stop.
Any taker? Honorable Sabi, Honorable Hunsinger.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. As far as I can recall the discussions, is this a minimum or is the sum total of what can be paid? Because as far as I can recall the discussions, we were saying if you prescribe a minimum, then the minister, after consultation, can then determine whatever.
Chairperson, this is the amount that we're going to be starting at, and then with there is that recognition that is made that this amount will keep with inflation, that it adjusted, it will be adjusted time to time by publication of a notice in the Gazette. Second to that is, this is not unheard of. In the recent life as a demani, and there was that order of a 20,000 that was made for funeral benefits. So we're trying to keep in line with those processes. Chris would want to add more to that.
Just further to confirm that the current average funeral expenses in the road accident fund is 20,000 rand. This is the current average paid.
Honorable
Humsinga. Chair, I'm unfortunately at section 34, where there were a couple of recommendations, one of which was to just make sure that what we speak of in terms of residence and citizenship is addressed adequately so that there's no confusion, because there's no support to a person as an ordinary resident as it reads here. The second aspect was section 34.2b, where there was reference to reasonable period in line 16, which was also regarded as very vague, and it should be more specific. And the third one I just want to draw your attention on was 34.3, where there was reference to income illegally earned, and that there was a recommendation that consideration should be given to a definition to define this, because it's so open and wide and includes so many people currently earning something yet not being under formal employment, which would be detrimental to the consideration of determining of income. So, Chair, I can't see how we can just pass 34, although I know you are pushing, you know, towards completion of what we're busy with, but please, let's consider those three aspects under Section 34.
From 32, we went to 35. Mr. Valence and the team, there's issues which are being raised for consideration here. Any taking?
Thanks, Chairperson. Just on the illegal income, you will recall, the committee will recall that we've provided that definition in the definitions section. Chris, you can deal with the remainder.
So the concern regarding citizens, non-citizens, other persons, and illegal foreigners come to play here. So subsection 27.4 deals with illegal foreigners in that they are entitled to emergency medical services, and that's all that they get. Then you've got citizens and permanent residents. Now, if you look at subsection 2, 34.2, they are excluded from this ordinary resident requirement. So a citizen and a permanent resident qualify for this benefit automatically. If you're an other person, that means you are a foreigner legally in the country. You need to now prove that you are ordinary resident here in terms of the requirement in subsection 2, paragraph A, for a period of 6 months per year calculated in a rolling period. So the qualifier only applies to other person. Other person is not a citizen or permanent resident. And it's also not an illegal foreigner, because they do not get this benefit because of subsection 27.4. So just to confirm, this is persons other than citizens or permanent residents who are legally in the country. They have to prove residency in terms of the six months in a year for a rolling 3 year period. That qualifier affects them only.
Honorable Humsinga.
So am I correct in saying there is no support to a person which is an ordinary resident?
Yes, I'm going to go again.
So ordinary resident is irrelevant for a citizen or a permanent resident. They always get this benefit. Ordinary resident as a requirement doesn't apply to someone who is a citizen or permanent resident. They get this benefit. The issue around ordinary resident only applies to legal foreigners. Illegal foreigners not getting qualifying for this. Legal foreigners qualifying for this if they are ordinary resident.
Okay. Chris Humsinga, Chris Willems has responded to you.
Thank you, Chair. If I can suggest a section 34.2c, just to clarify it, because there's still a category outstanding, and it's one sentence that would just clear everything in all three, maybe a definition in support of that. Although these are standard definitions in terms of foreign affairs, but if we could just get a C part that would just clarify it, particularly in terms of ordinary residents. And then the other aspect was that 34.2b, the reasonable period.
Honorable Ramatlakana, Honorable Mbanza.
No, Chair, I just suggest that on this one, rather than to rehashing the discussion we had, we should just agree that the amendment should be done in terms of the newer report that you're going to come up with. The reasonable period was defined as 30 days. We did talk about 30 days. Just fix that. And on this issue, there was a long discussion about who is ordinary, and we did say in that discussion that if you could do the definition, you clarify the definition in terms of the current act, it will be clearer in terms of when you deal with person, you know what is that person in terms of the definition. I think if you could just add all of those, then with a person other than, then it's clear what we're talking about, if you can just add the definition. So I'm trying to avoid and save time then to rehash what we've already had. That's a discussion.
Okay. Honorable Mbanza.
Yes, Chair. I thought I was still in 46 of the A list. Because I think we were there.
Already. Oh, before we go to 46, can we agree as proposed by Honorable Ramatlakane? Agreed. Thank you very much. Those insertions will be made. Honorable Rumsinga, we are now proceeding. 46.
Yes, Chair. I think there was this issue of the 20,000, which I think we should insist, even if we got the response that is an average, but we are of the view that it should be a minimum. And then the minister may determine what figure, but this should be the minimum. And then, Chair, on the issue of the pay an immediate family member of the deceased, I think that is also open-ended, because there are a lot of members in a family. So I don't know what is it actually saying. And also, if you look at the African family context, we don't differentiate between immediate and extended family. A family is a family. So I think if we can say something there, because we don't want anyone then being paid and then there's a dispute in the family and people are fighting amongst themselves. So at least maybe if we can say someone who has been identified by the immediate family or approved by a family, an immediate family, but at least someone who will be doing that on behalf of the family, being legitimized by the family. Because you can have anyone coming and say, okay, I'm an immediate family. And then it's giving the man, and then others, they say, no, he was not supposed to be the one. It was supposed to be so and so. Thank you.
Okay, Honorable Ramatlakane.
Did we not deal with it by saying that the foundation document that is going to be filled in by a person after the accident, it will capture who the family is of that person now. And that way it will be automatic that that person that has been written in the founding document as the day of the report of the accident, that's what is going to be taken as a part of the family. Because I think we're trying to obviate this problem, that is why we even said we would know who are the children, we would know who are the dependents, because that form that we must make provision for capturing everybody, that's part of that. Mm-hmm. On this, we did have a long discussion about the amount, and then which was 10,000. We ended up with saying let's go to a minimum. Let's say at least a minimum would be X amount of money. But the way I read it now, even though it's not said is a minimum, the 20,000 seems to be the money that is allocated subject to increase by the minister in Government Gazette. So if you read it, you can read it as a minimum, which is operational immediately, that can be changed tomorrow if the minister, in consultation with the other minister, come up with the increased amount. But it can't be less than that. That's my reading of it.
Honorable Humsinga.
I've got a new point. If we want to deal with this first, I'm happy to stand back, but I do have something in relation to Section 13.8.
Okay. Chris?
Chair, I just want to respond to the person being paid and the difference between this benefit and the automatic... let me just explain the issue that was previously discussed by the committee in terms of the claimant nominating beneficiaries. That would apply in terms of the income support benefits. In this instance, you are dealing with a funeral benefit, so the person could be killed in the accident. He has not completed anything, so he has not nominated anyone or identified his immediate family. It's a different benefit. So there's a defined term. Immediate family member is defined in Section 1. It is a defined term currently that refers to a spouse, a parent, a grandparent, or a sibling or descendant above the age of 18. So those categories of persons, the administrator should, because of Clause 45, be in a position to verify that that person is indeed one of these. As soon as you extend it beyond that to someone other than that, there won't be records backing up who that person is. And then you enter into an engagement with, you'll have to still find the immediate family member to verify if this person presenting himself as a representative of the family is indeed authorized to receive the money. So it's cleaner from an implementation perspective to pay an immediate family member as defined, because the administrator has the ability to verify whether that person is indeed one of the categories provided for in the definition.
Clear.
Chair, I'm talking on the funeral benefit now, and reserve the opportunity with your indulgence to go back to 38, just for one point there. As I understand it in the notes, clause 39 is rejected in totality, as it's expressed in the document. Yeah, in A. So. And it's replaced with what is suggested on page 13, with no reference to looking for anybody if family members can't be located. So I'm just battling to understand, what are we rejecting, what are we replacing, because as it stands now, everything falls away in terms of our concern around finding a family member of the deceased.
Advocate.
Thanks, Chairperson. Perhaps it's better that we go back to look at what the provision initially stood as, and that will inform the amendments that we currently have. Because stemming from the discussions that we held, the honourable members viewed this process as cumbersome, that you need to get all this information before there's any payment that's made. In this instance, as my colleague Chris has explained, somebody has passed on, we need to act, and as part of our responsibilities, we'll go out on our own to try to deal with this matter as efficiently and speedily as possible. So we are saying, from the family, we'd only need two documents, right? The death certificate, and that proves that this was related, was as a result of an accident. That's how we try to cure this, Chairperson, in terms of the discussions.
Honorable Lusinga?
Chair, that leaves us open with the process in the payment that would then result. So now we've established that it was a road accident and that indeed there is an unfortunate deceased. And what then is the procedure for making sure that the beneficiaries would get this funding? And the caution there is, or the fear is, that it might simply fall away, that it might simply be waived, which obviously gave justification for what we had in 39 subsection 2, which I submit should not be left out, but that in a way it should be attained, other than what the A-list suggested, that the whole section should fall away.
Honorable Ramatsakana.
No, Chair, we had a long discussion on this, and we concluded that the list that was required as a proof before the funeral was onerous, was huge, and that was impractical. We did say that for a funeral it has to happen within 5 days. All what is going, what is listed here, is not going to be achievable. That we need to simplify this. We in fact said we need to rephrase the whole section. And this is what my notes suggest here. And then we had a long discussion about the definition. The definition defining the person as it stands here, so that we know we're talking about, which is still a bit of a gap now, which has to be fixed. And then my understanding, we were clear about defining what is it that is required to prove. We basically raised whole lot of issues here, including the invoices, all of them that was required, that they should fall away. So if there is a new suggestion, we should motivate it why that new suggestion should come. Well, I'm satisfied with 46, that it covers, because A and a B in between, it brings all those things in that is must be in as a basic document that you require. I haven't had the motivation why we need to bring new other issues, why we're concerned about. Remember, this clause speaks to the funeral benefit, the funeral. Nothing else has got to do with that. So I haven't heard anything. I hear the Honorable Homsinga suggesting that we bring in the two, if it's impractical, to wait for a claim. But I think that I don't see why we should have another opening, escape gate, or impractical. I'm not sure whether we need it. I think it's straightforward enough. I think I'm one to say we should agree with it.
Okay, Honorable Siabi, Honorable Sibanda.
Thanks, Chair. No, that's what I wanted to say, that we had serious discussions about this, and ultimately we agreed that it must be reformulated to simplify the process. I would also support that we move with the Swan as in the A list.
Okay. Honorable Sibanda.
I'm sorry, Chairperson, I'm not well today, but I only to say, I also concur with my colleagues. We even highlighted that you are from different cultures and religion. I'm just reminding people where we started about this matter. I think the Comrade Ramaklakala and my colleague, we also covered it very well, that we discussed this matter and also made some proposals.
Okay. Honorable Humsinga.
Thank you, Jay. I would like to go back to 38, section 38, subsection 10, where we had the discussion around the cut-off age for youths being 18 in light of some families being challenged by youth that don't earn at the age of 18 or 19, but they are still studying, and that there was a suggestion to then increase it, the age cutoff to 21, whereas in the insurance industry, 23 is generally accepted for students at tertiary institutions.
Honorable Ramatsaka.
I think there was a discussion. We had a lot of shadow boxing on this one. But where we ended at 18. That's what my notes say. We didn't agree with 23 or 21. Certainly they were put on the table, but we ended up at 18, which means that 15 becomes 18.
Okay. Can we proceed? Honorable Ramataka?
Yeah, I'll proceed, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you very much.
42.
We are going to close 42.
Still on page 13. Clause 42, number 1. On page 21, after line 33, to insert 2. Subject to this act, comma, a dependent of a beneficiary of a temporary or a long-term income support benefit, comma, who died as a result of the injuries sustained in the road accident, comma, is entitled to a family support benefit without submitting a claim in the manner set out in the rules. Full stop.
Agreed.
Number 2. On page 21, in line 34, to omit 2 and to substitute 3.
Agreed.
Number 3. On page 21, from line 34, to omit funeral benefit in terms of section 39(2) and to substitute family support benefit in terms of subsection 2. Full stop.
Agreed.
Number 4. On page 21, in line 37, to omit 3 and to substitute 4. Full stop.
So agreed to?
Page 14. Number 1. On page 21, in line 43, after me, to insert subject to the duty to assist the claimant contemplated in subsection 56(2), comma, full stop.
Okay. Agreed.
Clause 46, number 1, on page 23, in line 53, to omit 1 year and to substitute 3 years. Full stop.
Agreed.
New chapter, number 1, that the following be a new chapter. Chapter 8, complaints, that is 55, 1.
Yes, you proceed, advocate. Honorable Humsinga, where do you want to go? Retrospective? Backwards? Reverse?
No, it's at the exact spot, Chair, I can promise you.
Okay.
Chair, we spoke about the unfortunate circumstances where a particular benefit, referring to family benefit, would just see to continue because the beneficiary fall away. And unfortunately, under the current design, the children would have to apply continuation of benefits, and that consideration would be given as to a smoother transition. In other words, not a process where the children have to apply, but there would be a mechanism whereby the children's benefit would continue automatically, other than for them to apply. I was just hoping to see something to that effect here, because I feel this is the right place where something like that could have been allowed for.
Chris, go ahead.
Chair, so the automatic provision is provided for where the beneficiary is a beneficiary of an income support benefit. So we've provided that now, that if in the event of that beneficiary dying, then the family support benefits kick in to the widow and the children and other dependents. That's provided for. In the instance where the widow dies, you would have had, by implication, you have a breadwinner that dies, and all the claims are managed at the same time. So it's not the widow that receives the only benefit. You are processing the benefits for the whole family component. So if the breadwinner died in the accident, the surviving spouse gets her benefit, as do the children and other dependents at the same time. So when she dies, it's not that they're sitting without a benefit, they're already receiving a benefit. There may be a recalculation in how that the money that flowed to her now flows to the rest of them. But they all receive the benefit. So if a surviving spouse dies, it does not now trigger a requirement for the benefit, for the children to claim. They would already be in receipt of the benefit. They would, their claims are managed simultaneously with the rest of the breadwinner's dependents. There's one. It's aligned to the current position as well.
Thanks, Chair. I think we agreed that it be part of the general provisions. We're still going to the...
Chair, if I may ask, where is this? Where, what clause, what section, where is this description? Where?
No, I'm trying to support you to say... I think we're still going
we're still
to the...
We're coming to the general provisions.
Provisions.
Okay. Let's proceed. Complaints agreed to, Honourable De Freitas.
Chair, we jumped straight to 55, but in 54, well, we changed the heading, good disqualification and removal of membership, and also in 54.1 it says a person, and we said a person must not nay. I don't see it reflected in the A list.
Section 54. We're not yet there.
You've jumped to 56, to 55. Mm-hmm. All right.
This is a new chapter which has been put. Yeah. Can we proceed to clause 48? 55. The new one, that's chapter 8, complaints. Any taker? You are supposed to deal with the new complaints. If you can proceed.
Complaints 1. Any qualifying person, comma, claimant or beneficiary may, comma, on the form and in the manner set out in the rules, comma, lodge a complaint with the administrator regarding any matter provided for in this act. Full stop. Number 2, the complaint must be lodged within 3 months of the complaint arising. Full stop. Number 3, the administrator may request a complainant to supply any additional information necessary to consider the complaint and to attend a meeting for the purpose of making an oral inquiry into the complaint. 4. The administrator must consider the complaint and respond in writing, comma, not later than 3 months after the complaint was lodged, comma, informing the complainant of the administrator's decision. Full stop.
There we are. Any taker? Honorable
Ramatlakana. I just want to ask, Chair, on 3, why do we specify oral inquiry? And what's the difference of the inquiry that you can set up to establish a complaint? I'm just trying to find out.
Any taker?
The road accident currently has this facility. It has a complaints department for the manager and staff, and they receive a number of complaints. It's sometimes necessary to engage with a complainant to understand the nature of the complaint. Not everyone sets out a complaint always in a manner that you could address the concern. So an empowering provision to engage with the complainant to understand the nature of the exact nature of the complaint. It would be helpful, yeah.
Honorable De Freitas.
Sorry, I have the same concern with my colleague next door here. So it specifically talks about oral inquiry, and I'm saying it's reducing it only to oral inquiry. Surely we should broaden it, you know, beyond just oral. And I don't know what the wording is, but I'm suggesting it gets changed. Thanks.
Okay. while she'll be considering the way that can be included in this, not to only focus on oral inquiry, Honorable Humsinga will assist you.
I'm actually wanting to put a point in addition, not to assist Jane. I do appreciate the addition around the complaints procedure. That's rather great. But Chair, I also want to ask whether we shouldn't put this in relation to what we have stated in the objectives of the Act that you would find in subsection 2, sub D, where the only reference slightly towards complaints is the word dispute. Either then to include complaint or in parallel to dispute, or to consider replacing complaints with the word dispute, since that would assist and then also give adequate linkage to both of those.
Chair, in terms of the last concern, in the A-list there's provision made for adding managing disputes under the duties. It's been added.
Okay. Honorable Ramatlakat.
Yeah, I would like to maybe just to add on 3. I think we could just simply oral or written inquiry. I think then covers both concerns.
Okay. Can we proceed? It's taken oral or written. Okay, let's proceed. State law advisor.
Still on page 14, Chairperson. Clause 48, number 1. On page 24, in line 18, to omit may and substitute must. Full stop.
Agreed. Let's move.
Number 2. On page 24, from line 22, to omit as a member of a law society and to substitute and enrolled as an advocate or an attorney under the Legal Practice Act, 2017, in brackets, A Act number 28.
Act number 28 of 2014.
It's an error, Chairperson.
2017.
Yes, Chairperson.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Full stop.
Full stop. Any taker? Agreed to? Okay, let's proceed.
This just question, the chapter 8, this is complaints, the heading. Honorable Humsinga was saying, was using the word dispute. And then the answer was that there is a section later that deals with the management of dispute. Is there a section like that, or should we be dealing using this particular chapter as dispute? The heading of it is a dispute. Yeah, maybe differently put. I mean, there could be a number of complaints, but which are not necessarily related to the claim. There could be complaint that I actually don't like this administrator who's sitting here. That's got nothing to do with the claim. But if it's claim related, then can't be a complaint. It either has to be a dispute or a disagreement. But there's something that has to do with that. If we were to change that just a complaint to a dispute, that's what you're dealing with all the time. Mm-hmm. Even that is dispute, you still have to listen to what people have to say. They have to submit an oral or they have submit a written report about it.
Okay. Honorable Humsinga.
Chair, if I could just ask attention to section 47, sub 4. In 47 sub 4, we're placing three things next to each other in terms of procedure and processing. If the administrator rejects a claim, the claimant must be informed in writing within 14 days of the decision of the claimant's right to appeal the decision of the administrator. In other words, there is no room between that for what we've just accepted in terms of a complaints portion. So we might just want to reconsider the procedure and also the 14 days after which only an appeal process is possible, because they obviously this whole complaint procedure can then conveniently fit into.
Chairperson, okay. For a start, I think we accept that probably we need to substitute complaint with dispute at the start, and then that we can perhaps under 4 add that within 14 days of the decision of the complainant's right to lodge a dispute, then it follows what the rest of the section, the clause provides, Chairperson.
Agreed to. Okay. Can we move on? Before move on, Ramatlakat.
Well, I don't want to take you back, Chair, on this. We've been talking about 48, but my document that I have, it doesn't have anything on the AE on the 47 on this. I don't find 47. It's 48. It's 40. It's 55. Then it jumps to 47. 48. I mean, I don't have a 47. Do you have a 47 on the A list? I don't have 47.
No.
So where do you get 47? Okay, but I see where you get a 47 on the bill itself. No, it's on the bill. Now,
it's a new chapter.
No. Now, I don't, I'm not fighting with you. No. All I wanted to say, this, the A list has omitted something on 47. I have my notes here on here. There were certain things that needed to be done. Which I suspect this is now a dispute. We said a dispute clause. If the dispute clause is this one, then it take care of the 47. Then it become 47. And in it, we also talked about a mediation.
Yep.
I don't know, so the mediation may come later, or is it part of this part? Just to clarify, Chair, just to understand, we talked about the time frame that we need to do this to finalize. So I just want to find out whether I'm reading the same document together. So is there any reason why we don't have 47 on here, or 47 is meant to be 45, 55?
So, just in terms of the numbering on the A list, that unfortunately doesn't track all the changes currently. So, if we look at the bill, the dispute provision that's now 40, clause 55 on the A list, the intent is for that, and again, this numbering will change, for that to be a separate section that follows immediately after 47. So it'll be. If you ignore the numbering changes, this dispute clause currently 55 in the A list will become 48 in the bill, and then the next chapter would be appeals committee, and then it goes on from there. But all of the numbering will change. The consequential changes will happen as we would.
But dispute wouldn't be part of chapter 8.
The intent is not for it to be part of chapter 8.
Because it is currently under the A list.
Yes, Chapter 8, in other words, disputes wouldn't be part of the Chapter 8 as we see it in the bill under the Appeals Committee.
It'll be a 48.
It will be 47.
And in Chapter 8 will start with the Appeals Committee.
Assuming the chapters don't, chapter numbering, that they'll be in different chapters, but yes, they'll be different in the reason being that the disputes provision is managed by the administrator, whereas the appeals committee is a separate functionary appointed by the minister. It's not in-house, it's not done in-house by the...
Honorable Ramatlakana raised an issue that we spoke to the issues of mediation and the time period within Section 47. Where do we put that? You want to rephrase, Honorable Ramatlakana, what you are saying? I didn't hear them respond. Yeah.
Thanks, Chairperson. The insertion that we made is meant to cover that as well, in terms of what is it that we need to do in terms of dealing with any complaint or dispute that a claimant would lodge. It's meant to cover that, Chairperson.
Honorable Humsinga, Honorable Ramatlakana.
It was quite clear that what was complaints has now become disputes, and the procedure around that, which is an activity which is generated from an unhappiness with a successful claimant. So it's after the claim has been lodged, somewhere in the process there's been a problem, and instead of going to the appeals committee, there is this opportunity now to just lay a complaint, to approach the administrator directly and try to resolve this. Mediation is a particular type of how to resolve this. And I would suggest that this should be a subsection of disputes as an option because there's a particular input, a particular additional direction which opens up in asking for mediation, in that a particular neutrality then enters into the play, opposed to the administrator that might be directly involved, hence the opportunity for a dispute other than to go to the appeals procedure. So I would suggest then that, as it was suggested, that the new 47, or the 47 remains as is, but then the new 48 would carry the complaint, the dispute portion, and then the 49 carries the description of mediation before Chapter 8.
Can you agree to that? Honorable Ramatlakana, Honorable...
So, Chair, I think it makes sense that once we have a section that deals with a dispute, and those disputes could be mediated to be resolved in an amicable way without having to spend all lots of money into it. It can, I think it should follow as a logic. Or logically should follow that way.
Maybe what we need to, as this honorable committee, we need to remind the department around, was that there was a Dr. Eglin? Yeah, Yonai, who made a proposal as to how they deal with issues, which actually, there are experts who actually, when there is a dispute, it doesn't have to follow all those processes independently. There will be people who will try to mediate between the two parties. And that is why we also believe that probably this will assist instead of people going to appeals and all these things when there is a dispute. We deal with it at that level, and probably that is why the members so feel there's a need for proposal. Mahat.
Permission, Chairperson, to... Okay, this is my take on this. Chairperson, with the RABS bill, we are trying to... I'm not discounting what the submissions that were made by Dr. Edling, But with this process now, we're trying to minimize going the litigation route. And what in most instances mediation does is it is not binding. It's going to be a long and tedious process that would involve acquiring services of consultants, most of the time it will be with a legal background, and there will be a question of costs associated with that process itself unfolding. So now, with that, we thought that having a dispute provision or complaints would seek to address that. Thanks, Chairperson. Chris wants to add, and sorry, Chairperson.
If I can take you back to the presentation made by Dr. Edler, they explained that the process they engage with is medical negligence claims. That's the bulk of what they deal with. Mm-hmm. So they engage with parties and insurance providers, insurers, who are at liberty to compromise their position in terms of arriving at a settlement. The emphasis was placed that in a mediation process, you're dealing with the needs of the parties as opposed to their rights. Now, what's different under this dispensation is that the rule of law requires the administrator to give effect to the legal framework. It's not possible to compromise where the legislation, for instance, provides that you are entitled to a benefit within certain parameters and where the claimant is not happy with the decision of the administrator for having applied the law. So there is no discretion available to the administrator to then assess the person's needs and compromise where that compromise would be contrary to the Act. So in a commercial environment, parties are free to come to an arrangement. In a framework such as this where the administrator applies legislation, it has no discretion to go outside that framework. Consequently, in a mediation scenario, in dealing with disputes on claims in this legislation, it would be of little use to the administrator or the complainant, because what you need to address is the rights of the parties. What is the rights of the claimant under the legislation? Have you, as the administrator, complied with your duty to assess it in terms of the framework, and then you come to a decision? It cannot be compromised. So it needs to now go to a process which will then be the disputes process, where there's a second opportunity to address the concern, and if that's not adequately resolved, it then needs to go to an appeals process where the rights of the parties are assessed, and if there's no joy, then that decision is reviewed under PAJA in a court. But mediation, in addition to that, would prolong the process, and there would be little benefit because the administrator doesn't have the right to compromise certain provisions in terms of the legislation.
Honourable members, there we are. Honourable Ramatakana, Honourable Humsinga, we must be mindful of time that Parliament will be sitting at 2 o'clock today.
Is it 2 or 3? It's 2.
Yeah.
No, Chair, quick one. I hear the explanation, which is explanation that in fact explain the exclusion. Why is it not written as part of the A list? Ordinarily, what should have happened, it shouldn't have been a decision of those who compiled the document of what they perceived, what has been discussed. It should be put to the meeting, the complication of it. Because exclusion could equal, and I don't want to use the wrong term, it could equal manipulation of the report that's supposed to come before us. Because you have your own reasons that you're now explaining. So I think it should have, at normal all the time,
we should be able to be fairly open about it, so that we don't start asking questions in order to get an explanation of something that does not necessarily even exist on paper. We're now relying onto our notes when we have a room full of lawyers. That's supposed to help us to do this. I don't take this lightly because I understand the reason. But I simply detest the exclusion, because it means that this is second guessing without us being provided with a substantive answers to the problem or the complication. Having said that, Chair, because of time, perhaps we should accept that the dispute process and how we're going to handle the dispute gravitate towards the middle and addressing the issue of mediation and addressing it as under the dispute, because that clause will make that provision. So I would more or less agree that perhaps we should live with the fact that there is this complication that is now being explained, but explained very late in the day that we are asking for it and then get explained. So I would think that we should except that we'll drop the mediation and then run with the dispute, because by and large it may arrive at closer to same conclusion. So you cut out the steps of mediation and go into a dispute. It's a halfway house, in my view. That's my take on this, Chair, but I don't think that, yeah.
Honorable Humsinga, halfway house.
Yeah, Chair, also mindful of the time, I think it shouldn't be seen as one following the other. In other words, a full dispute process and then a full mediation process. It shouldn't work like that. And it can certainly be designed as such. Therefore, I submit that consideration be given as in a parallel process, where mediation would simply mean at the request of the administrator to include particular specialists in order to try and sort this issue out at a dispute phase. And it's not suggested that there should be several alternatives. It should be quick, it should be efficient and effective, but my understanding of the benefit in having a mediation process is that you have access to medical specialists. That's in particular very important in trying to resolve this, but then on an impartial specialist professional level and not just looking at documents which has been submitted, because we must always go back to reality in that a file would be opened and the only thing that you can rely on was submitted documentation. Whereas in a process of mediation, in trying to resolve the dispute, one could call specialists in and they could then also help expertise.
I think you can achieve that. The same thing you can achieve by using the same clause of dispute, without necessarily spelling out the mediation. You can call on the expertise to come and sort out some of the things. But I think let's agree to this mediation, because I understand the cost factor that has been put there on the table as a consideration.
Agreed. Can we move to the next? We had a new clause. We finished the new clause of going to 48? We've done 48. Okay, let's proceed.
On page 15, Chairperson. On page 24, in line 23, to omit 10 and to substitute 5.
Okay.
Full stop.
Agreed.
Number 4, on page 24, in line 24, to omit alternative. Full stop.
Agreed.
Number 5, on page 24, in line 28, to omit 10 and to substitute 5. Full stop.
Agreed to.
Number 6, on page 24, in line 32, to omit 10 and to substitute 5. Full stop.
Agreed to.
Clause 53, number 1, on page 25, after line 31, to insert 3. In the event of a breach of subsection 2, the minister may remove a member or alternate after having A, given the member or alternate a reasonable opportunity to make representations, and B, considered any representations received. Full stop.
There we are, agreed to. Great, let's move on.
Clause 54.
Honorable De Freitas.
On clause 53, it says you're given the member or alternate. First of all, just unpack the alternate and also a reasonable opportunity. What does that mean?
Can we respond?
The alternate is one of the members appointed. So there's a member appointed to appeals committee and each member has an alternate. That's appointed by the minister. So if an alternate did not comply with the requirements in subsection 2, then subsection 3 now provides a mechanism through which the minister may remove that alternate or member, depending on who was responsible for the particular conduct.
Okay. Are you fine?
What does reasonable opportunity mean?
There'll be afforded time within which to respond to the reason why the minister would want to say, for the following reasons, I would want to remove you. It's a right to be heard.
Can we put that in there? It doesn't say that in here. Can we put that in
there? In the previous chapters, we indicated days, 7 days. So we also need to be consistent.
Yeah.
Honorable Humsinga?
Chair, can I talk on 52?
Okay.
The capping of remuneration was something that we pointed out there.
Capping of remuneration. Yeah. And it doesn't appear here.
Chair, there was a discussion around that, and it was a differentiation made between board members who attend board meetings, and in that instance, there's now provision made that their stipend is capped to an annual fee regardless of the number of meetings attended, whereas these committees would be standing committees. They're not. So these committees will sit continuously. It's not like a board coming in 4, 5, 6 times a year. And that the minister, in terms of the alternates, may pay them on for flexibility reasons, pay them on a per meeting basis, whereas the permanent appointees will get a salary or a stipend.
Agreed to.
I think there's justification to just specify that, since it's a very valid distinction between
justification the two. To specify will be done. Can we proceed?
Still on page 15, Chairperson, clause 54, number 1, on page 25, in line 32, to omit from and to substitute off. Full stop.
Agreed.
Number 2, on page 25, in line 33, to omit may and to substitute must.
Full stop.
Clause 55.
Just one moment, Honorable Sally.
Thanks, Chair. On the heading, disqualification and removal from...
Removal for?
I think there was a discussion. I'm just confused by this from and off. There was a discussion that you don't just talk of membership, but you must also... It must also be clear that it's from the appeals committee.
Yep.
We'll qualify that by saying members of the appeals committee, Chairperson.
Agreed. Honorable Hunsinga.
So we suggested disqualification and removal of the appeals committee.
Disqualification and the removal of the appeals committee membership. Was it that? Or just appeals committee members? Whatever. Okay. Honorable Sari, the heading.
Disqualification and removal of membership from appeals committee. Something like that.
Oh, okay. It's fine. That sounds better English. Can we proceed?
On page 15, clause 55, number 1, on page 26, in line 4, to omit 30 and to substitute 108. Full stop.
Agreed.
Clause 56, number 1, on page 26, in line 20, after 56, to insert 1. Full stop.
Agreed. Honorable Hunsinga.
Thank you, Chair. Just something that might have slipped through. Section 54, subsection 2, just below C, before 3. We suggested that consideration should be taken to include reference to section 53, subsection 2.
Agreed.
I'm referring to section 54, subsection 2, ABC. So as one of the conditions to remove a member, that reference should be made to section 53, subsection 2.
Okay. It's agreeable.
Agreed.
Yep. Can we proceed?
Chairperson, page 16, number 2, on page 26, after line 23, to insert number 2, the administrator must assist the injured person, comma, claimant or beneficiary to obtain the documents required to submit a claim and to process a benefit, full stop. Number 3, the administrator must pay the reasonable and necessary costs associated with obtaining the documents contemplated in subsection 2. Full stop.
Agreed. Thank you. Let's proceed.
Still on page 16, clause 60. Number 1, on page 26, in line 37, after health, to insert and the Minister of Finance. Full stop.
Honorable Hunsinga.
Chair, still on page 26, but then the last section there, which is section 55, 2, I might have missed it, but there was a suggestion to change the 30 days in line 4 to 180 days. Was it changed? And then in terms of the whole chapter 8, I don't see there's a definition of the appeals committee under definitions. We might have missed that one as well.
That has been taken into consideration earlier on. I think Honorable Mpanza spoke to that. Yeah, it will be, the definition will be made. Can we proceed?
Number 2, on page 27, in line 5, to omit it. Full stop.
Can we agree? Let's proceed.
Number 3, on page 27, in line 11, after adjust, to insert upward. Full stop.
Adjust upwards. Agreed? Let's move.
Clause 61, number 1, on page 27, in line 35, to omit unless it is impractical to do so. Full stop.
Agreed. silence is golden. Let's proceed.
Clause 62, number 1, on page 27, in line 4, to omit 3 and to substitute 6. Full stop.
Honorable Humsinga.
Chair, I recall that under section 61, subsection 2, the board may was suggested that it must be must.
Must, yes.
And then the last sentence in line 35 was suggested that from such comment the sentence should end, and that unless it is impractical to do so, that should be removed.
Yep. Chris?
Yes. In terms of subsection 2 on section 61, there was a discussion. I remember the issue was raised whether this must be must or may. And in the section, it is also may. So the minister may, in consultation with the Minister of Health, establish training and establish these panels. But it's not a must. It's not a must that it must be there for this act to operate. It's something that it's a discretionary power if he wants to exercise it on a future date.
Just, you know, where is that discretionary power expressed?
In the section referred to, section 36.
So it's a law unto a law itself. Because I would imagine that it must be a must in terms of us writing this bill. It must be gazetted.
It's very similar to giving the minister regulation-making powers. So the minister must prescribe, and then in consult, and he will provide and may prescribe as there's a catch-all as well in terms of the regulation-making power. So in Section 36, and we have that currently in the current regulations to the Road Accident Fund Act, the minister may, for instance, prescribe training and requirements for assessors to assess serious injury under the current Road Accident Fund legislation. This was challenged. And it was confirmed that the wording is accurate. There's nothing wrong in legislation to give the minister that discretion. And the fact that there is that discretion doesn't mean that the minister must exercise it.
Okay.
And Chairperson, the other point was unless it is impractical to do so, so that will fall off.
Okay. Honorable Humsinga, Honorable Ramatlakane.
No, Chair, I think that that it is allowable in law, in lawmaking, that some of the discretion is done in the may. And I agree with this section that we can agree with it. We don't have to go to war with it. I think this is accept. Yeah.
Chair, I would declare war on that. I would say it must be a must. We cannot allow this discretion, particularly not in terms of what is described here as A and B. For the sake of transparency, it must be known what training programs these assessors would have. Why hide it? Furthermore, it must be known for general public what the criteria and accreditation for assessors is. Why do you want to hide this?
Honorable Ramatlakane?
No. My reading is not that it gives the right to hide. No. If it's, it doesn't, there is no words hiding here at all. I'm reading everything here. I think we should accept that he may do this, that power that is, it's a discretionary power that is allowable.
Honorable Siabi?
I think, Chair, we had a debate here that day, and we were all here. The same argument was presented, but it was clarified, and ultimately we accepted the formulation as it is. Let us not reopen it.
Okay.
And I would appeal that, Chair, you call for Humsinga to focus and concentrate.
Honorable, they say there's no need for war. So we just need to disagree in order to agree that it may. Agreed.
Jay, I assume we are on section 62,
okay.
Subsection 1. where there was a suggestion of 6 months instead of the 3 months in line 40.
Okay, agreed. Let's continue.
We are agreeing.
Let's proceed. You see, when you go to the battleground, you need to have all the things. So he has already moved. Let's proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. Still on page 16, clause 62, number 2. On page 27, in line 43, to omit 3 and to substitute 5. Full stop.
Agreed.
Clause 63, number 1. On page 28, after line 43, to insert 4. The laws specified in the first column of Schedule 2 are amended or repealed to the extent set out in the third column of that schedule. Full stop.
Agreed. It's a good one. Yeah, you can just stand up and tense. Can we proceed?
Clause 64. Clause rejected.
Clause rejected. Where are the fighters being rejected? They should be here to come and reject. Okay, can we proceed?
Page 17, clause 65, clause rejected, full stop.
Agreed.
New schedule. Number one, that the following be a new schedule. Schedule 2, section 71 in brackets. Then there is column number and year of law. There's a short title in the column in the middle. Then the last one, the extent of repeal or amendment. Act number 58 of 1962. That is short title, the Income Tax Act 1962. The extent of repeal or amendment. The amendment of section 10 by the insertion after item 1V in subsection 1 GB B full in capital letter of the following item. 5. Benefits paid in terms of Chapter 6 of the Road Accident Benefit Scheme Act, 2017, Act number 17 of 2017, full stop.
You are just tipping. Do you have an act? Honorable Siavi, Honorable Ramatakani.
On that one, I agree, Chair, but I wanted to check. We didn't deal with Chapter 9 general provisions. There was something we said should be part of general provisions, the automatic something, where we don't want, we said our children or spouses, it should just be automatic. They don't need to go through applications. And we said it should be part or should be covered under general provisions.
That aspect was dealt with in terms of the new insertion in section 42, which dealt with claim procedures. So the current 42.2 deals with instances where there are no claim forms required. So we've addressed this earlier in that the automatic provision that allows for what was discussed, children and spouses not claiming, is addressed in that insertion earlier.
Okay, understood, agreeable. Let's proceed.
Act number 56 of 1996, Road Accident Fund Act, 1996, full stop. 2. The insertion in section 1 above the definition convey the following definition. Administrator means the administrator established in terms of Section 3 of the Road Accident Benefit Scheme Act, 2017, full stop.
Agreed to? Any taker? Nothing? Let's proceed.
Number 3, the deletion in Section 1 of the definitions for agent, board, chief executive officer, fund, lift club, and reward. Full stop.
Agreed. 4.
Number 4, the deletion of subsection 1 in section 2.
Agreed to. Proceed.
Number 5, the substitution, page 18, section 2 of paragraph A in subsection 2 for the following.
Any taker? No one? Agreed to?
2A, subject to section 28.1, the multilateral motor vehicle accident fund established by agreement concluded between the contracting parties on 14 February 1989, comma, shall cease to exist, comma, and all money credited to that fund immediately before the commencement of this act shall vest in the fund is a deletion. Then we insert administrator, comma, all assets, liabilities, comma, rights and obligations, comma, existing as well as accruing, comma, of the first mentioned fund shall devolve upon the fund is taken out, administrator is the new insertion, comma, and any reference in any law or document to the said multilateral motor vehicle accidents fund shall, unless clearly inappropriate, comma, be construed as a reference to the fund in bold, that is a deletion, administrator, and the line is an insertion, full stop.
Agreed. Let's proceed.
Number 6, the deletion of subsections 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and 16, full stop.
Agreed.
Number 7, the substitution in section 17 for the following. 17, liability of fund is in bold, means deletion, administrator underlined means insertion, and agents. 1, the fund, that is bold, is deletion, administrator underlined insertion, or an agent shall A, subject to this act, comma, in the case of a claim for compensation under this section arising from the driving of a motor vehicle where the identity of the owner of the driver therefore has been established, B, subject to any regulation made. Page 19, under section 26, comma, in the case of a claim for compensation under this section arising from the driving of a motor vehicle where the identity of neither the owner nor the driver thereof has been established, comma, be obliged to compensate any person, in brackets, the third party, for any loss or damage which the third party has suffered as a result of any bodily injury to himself or herself or death of or any bodily injury to any other person, comma, caused by or arising from the driving of a motor vehicle by any person at any place within the Republic, comma, if the injury or death is due to the negligence or other wrongful act of the driver or of the owner of the motor vehicle or of his or her employee in the performance of the employee's duty as employee, provided that the obligation of the fund is deletion, administrator is in session to compensate a third party for non-pecuniary loss shall be limited to compensation for a serious injury as contemplated in subsection 1A, capital letter, and shall be paid by way of a lump sum, full stop. 1AA, assessment of a serious injury shall be based on a prescribed method adopted after consultation with medical service providers and shall be reasonable in assuring that injuries assessed in relation to circumstances of third party, full stop. B, the assessment shall, page 20, be carried out by a medical practitioner registered as such under the Health Professions Act, 1974, in brackets, Act number 56 of 1974, full stop. 2.3a, no interest calculated on the amount of any compensation which a court awards to any third party by virtue of the provisions of subsection 1 shall be payable unless 14 days have elapsed from the date of the court's relevant order. Full stop.
Agreed. Thank you. Proceed.
B, in ensuing an order as to costs on making such award, comma, the court may take into consideration any return offer, comma, including a return offer without prejudice in the course of settlement negotiations, comma, in settlement of the claim consent, comma, made by the fund, the deletion, administrator, is an insertion, or an agent before the relevant summons was served, full stop. Number four, where a claim for compensation under subsection 1A includes a claim for the cost of the future accommodation of any person in a hospital or nursing home or treatment of or rendering of a service or supplying of goods to him or her, then fund, deletion, administrator, insertion, or an agent shall be entitled, comma, after furnishing the third party consent with the undertaking to that effect or a competent court has directed, fund, a deletion, administrator, insertion, or the agent to furnish such, page 21, undertaking to compensate, one, Roman figure, the third party in respect of the said costs after the costs have been incurred and on a proof thereof, or two, the provider of such service or treatment directly, comma, notwithstanding section 19C or D, comma, in accordance with the tariffs contemplated in subsection 4B, capital letter, B, includes a claim for future loss of income or support, full stop, comma, sorry, Chairperson. The amount payable by the fund is a deletion, administrator is an insertion, or the agent shall be paid by way of a lump sum or installments as agreed upon. C, includes a claim for loss of income or support, comma, the annual loss, comma, irrespective of the actual loss, comma, shall be proportionately calculated to an amount not exceeding 1,273,863 per year in the case of a claim for loss of income, and 2,273,863 per year, comma, in respect of each deceased breadwinner, comma, in the case of a claim for loss of support, full stop. 4A, A, the fund is taken out, administrator is the insertion, shall, comma, by notice in the Gazette, adjust the amounts referred to in subsection 4C quarterly, comma, in order to counter the effect of inflation, full stop. B, in respect of any claim for loss of income or support, the amounts adjusted in terms of paragraph A shall be the amounts set out in the last notice issued to the date on which the cause of action arose. Full stop.
Agreed.
Page 22, 4B in capital letter A, the liability of the fund deletion, the fund administrator insertion, or an agent regarding any tariff contemplated in subsections A, in subsections 4A, comma, 5 and 6 shall be based on the tariffs for health services provided by public health established contemplated in National Health Act, comma, 2003, Act number 61 of 2003, comma, and shall be prescribed after consultation with the Minister of Health, full stop. B, the tariff for emergency medical treatment provided by a healthcare provider contemplated in National Health Care Act, comma, 2003, 1, shall be negotiated between the fund is taken out, administrator is an insertion, and such health care providers, and two, shall be reasonable, taking into account factors such as the cost of such treatment and the ability of the fund, it's a deletion, administrator, insertion, to pay, full stop. C, in the absence of a tariff for emergency medical treatment, the tariffs contemplated in paragraph A shall apply, full stop. Number five, where a third party is entitled to compensation in terms of this section and has incurred costs in respect of accommodation of himself or herself or any other person in a hospital or nursing home or the treatment of or any service rendered or goods supplied to himself or herself or any other person, comma, the person who provided the, page 23, accommodation or treatment, or rendered the service or supplied the goods, in bracket, the supplier, may, comma, notwithstanding section 19C or D, comma, claim an amount in accordance with the tariff contemplated in subsection 4B, capital letter, direct from the fund, a deletion, administrator, insertion, or an agent on a prescribed form, comma, and such claim shall be subject, comma, mutatis mutandis, comma, to the provisions applicable to the claim of the third party concerned, comma, and may not exceed the amount which the third party could, comma, but for this subsection, comma, have recovered, full stop. Number six, the fund. Fund is a deletion. Administrator is an insertion, comma, or an agent. With the approval of the fund, fund, deletion, administrator, insertion, comma, may make an interim payment to the third party out of the amount to be awarded in terms of subsection 1 to the third party in respect of medical costs, comma, in accordance with the tariff contemplated in subsection 4B, capital letter, comma, loss of income and loss of support, provided that the fund, a deletion, administrator, insertion, or such agent shall, comma, notwithstanding anything to the contrary in any law contained, comma, only be liable to make an interim payment insofar as such costs have already been incurred and any such losses have already been suffered. Full stop. Number eight. The subsection in section 18 for the following.
Honorable members, there we are. Agreed. Any taker? Honorable
Humsinga. Chair, in reference to what we had on page 22, as I read it, 4B subsection A says that tariffs must be finalized in accordance to a particular arrangement, and then C, in a way, then just cancels that whole procedure, in that if it's not there, then I can just sort of carry on without the tap. So I'm just trying to understand the necessity of having the provision with a tariff structure that's needed, and then in C, where it's just waived. Other than that, I would like to know, where are the tariffs? I was hoping to get it in the schedule, because it was part of what was said that we would see today, the tariffs in terms of contracted as well as the tariffs in terms of non-contracted schedule.
Proceed.
Chair, just in terms of what we're dealing with in Schedule 2 is insertions in the current Road Accident Fund Act. So these tariffs exist, and or where they existed were declared unconstitutional in respect of the non-emergency medical tariff. So this does not deal with tariffs in respect of the RAPS bill, the actual bill. This just provides for substituting the fund as a legal entity with a new legal entity administrator. So all of this doesn't, this is current law, it's in place. It's not affected by the schedule. As regards the tariff was submitted.
In your inbox. No. Relax. We got the tariffs in our inboxes today. Agreeable that it should have come earlier on, but be that as it may, it doesn't stop us from looking into this, and it also doesn't stop us from coming back once we have gone through the tariffs, so that we are able to talk to the tariffs. Agreed, let's proceed. Before we proceed, honorable members, we are left with like 10 minutes. We thought that we will proceed until 5:30, but apparently Parliament is starting at 2:00 today. I just want to get an indication as to tomorrow who will be available. From 9:30 to midday. Because we need to correct through and through. I see 1, 2, 3, 4 hands. All of you will be here.
Is that enough time? Sorry, I thought we'd be longer, to be honest with you. Is that enough time for tomorrow?
For tomorrow, yes, we'll start at 9:30 until we go to Parliament tomorrow. Oh, there's no Parliament tomorrow. Until we finish the... Why are you intimidating me? So I just wanted to establish that we should just probably finish this. Wow, still long. Honorable Siabi, will you be there?
In the afternoon, yeah.
In the afternoon, we're starting in the morning. Honorable Banza, you are there?
In the morning,
I'm not. Okay, Honorable Sibande, you are there? Honorable Ramatakana, you are there?
No, Chair.
You're not there. Honorable De Freitas, then it's 3. Honorable Humsinga?
Yes, Chair, I'll definitely be here.
Then we'll not have a quorum if Honorable Siabi is not here. And therefore it will mean that we will shift this until the second term. Honorable De Freitas?
Are you saying that tomorrow's meeting's not happening at all and we're doing it the first week
tomorrow's
of the second?
Meeting will not happen because we don't have a quorum. We need to have 6 members.
Okay.
Honorable Siabi.
I will rearrange, Chair.
You will reorganize as well.
Be available in the morning.
Oh, okay. therefore, minus Honorable Ramatlakana, we still will be able to correct. Can we agree that we start at 9:30, the latest, until probably tomorrow, until probably lunchtime? Then we can be able to finish everything that we're supposed to do and go home for the constituency week. Where have we finished? We agreed where we were in page 23. We finished 6.
Chairperson, I was going to start
with 6.
Number 8.
Number 8.
Yes, Chairperson.
Can we agree that we stop and then tomorrow we'll start at number 8, which will be a continuation of today's meeting, and then we will take it from there because the bearers of parliament are now calling us. Unfortunately, I thought that we're going to finish the whole A list today and then tomorrow we will not work. Don't cry. Butoka is still nearby, so no need to cry. We will work tomorrow and be able to try and finish the A list. So that, remember, we're having 3 weeks adjournment from tomorrow. When we rise tomorrow, we'll have 3 weeks before we can be able to. It's just a small area which is left. The most critical things have been dealt with. Honorable member, let's try and not be late. Venue will be communicated. Venue will be communicated to honorable members. Let's adjourn today's meeting and go to parliament, and then we will resume tomorrow, 9:30. Venue will be communicated.